You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. We're talking National League East today. I'm Matthew Leach, and I'll be talking with MLB.com's five National League East beat reporters. It's still a situation where the Nationals have a pretty commanding lead, but they've still got some games against the Braves, and Atlanta could yet make it interesting. And then after that, we'll be talking about the third-place Marlins and Giancarlo Stanton's MVP candidacy. We'll be talking about the Mets' young pitchers and their future. And we're talking about the Phillies sneakily playing pretty good ball for about half a season now, and how they've managed to hang around and might end up with a better season than I think a lot of people's perception might be of what they've done. So thanks for listening in. We'll be talking ball. Talking Washington Nationals with MLB.com's Nationals beat reporter, Bill Ladson. Bill, it's been an interesting week for a team that, at least according to the standings, should be cruising right now. They're looking at what's going on in the ninth inning, and it's kind of interesting to try and figure out. Rafael Soriano isn't closing here for at least a couple of days, but he's also not pitching at all. First of all, what exactly is his situation? Is he resting an injury? Is he trying to get his mechanics sorted out? Just specifically with Soriano first, what's going on with him?
A couple of things, Matthew. First of all, he's trying to get his mechanics sorted out because the slider is so bad. I mean, for some reason, he can't keep it down. The home runs he gave up against the Phillies on Friday were both sliders. So they told him, take 2 days off, rest your mind. And then today, in fact, which is Monday, he's supposed to work on his slider. So hopefully things will work out within the next couple of days. He'll be back closing again. Now, when he gets back in the bullpen, he is not going to be the closer per se. He's going to be like maybe coming in the seventh inning, eighth inning, who knows. But he's not going to be a closer at first. But Matt Williams said he wants him to get his job back, and that's the plan right now.
And that does lead into my next question. When he comes back, how do they use him? And does he have to be used sort of carefully, or does he go into high-leverage situations that just aren't ninth-inning high-leverage situations?
I think high-leverage where it's not the ninth inning. I mean, I think sometimes we forget that this guy was a setup man for Mariano Rivera 2 years ago. So, I mean, if he's not the closer, I don't think it's that big of a deal. So we'll see what happens. I mean, the thing I like about Soriano, he realizes that he's not pitching well. He's acknowledged it. He wasn't angry when he was told that, hey, you're not going to be the closer for a few days. So he's taking this well, and hopefully he'll get his mind right.
He hasn't been terrible overall, and up to a few weeks ago, he was having a very good year. He was a guy who was seriously considered, you know, he was an all-star candidate. What's the source of why things have been rougher here lately?
It's basically the slider, Matthew. I mean, his slider is so bad, and it's, in some cases, he's had some bad defense, behind him. But to be honest with you, his slider is just not working, and that's one of his go-to pitches. And he doesn't have a blazing fastball. I mean, he's in the low 90s, but nothing to say, oh, wow, it's unhittable. So he has to get another pitch working, or he's in trouble.
So how does that happen? I mean, how does it happen for a guy leans on a pitch and then suddenly doesn't have that pitch?
It's got to be a mental thing, Matthew. That's the only thing I can think of. I did think, as you mentioned earlier, I did think maybe it was an injury problem, but it's not. I mean, it's a mental thing, and he just can't get that slider down. So you just hope that Steve McCaddy, the pitching coach, can help him get his act together. That's the only thing I can say.
In the interim, what do they do? I mean, it's the one good piece of news here is they do have a lot of candidates and a lot of guys who are viable options in the ninth.
Yes. The plan right now is that it's basically a bullpen by committee. Matt Williams did not say that, but it's basically a bullpen by committee because he said he's going to use players based on matchups. Yesterday he used Drew Storen. I wouldn't be surprised tomorrow. Today he uses, Tyler Clippard. He even said Matt Thornton could be in the mix. And I know he loves Aaron Barrett. So it could be any of those four guys. And I'm not expecting just one guy to close games.
Would they like to find? I mean, it's not going to be just one guy right now. Would it be a valuable thing and a desirable thing over the next 3 weeks to figure out who the primary plan B is on the off chance Soriano doesn't get sorted out?
Oh, there's no question about it. And if I had to take a guess, I think it would be Storen, because of all the guys, he's the one who has the most experience. But we'll see what happens. He looked awesome yesterday on Sunday. So hopefully, they can figure it out. I think Matt Williams will figure it out. But we'll see what happens.
I just want to follow a little more, because, you said, and I it makes sense that, what Williams would like is for Soriano to get back and reclaim that and sort of get everything set up. But it's not necessarily a given that he does get it back. I mean, how easy is it for you to envision a scenario where, come the playoffs, somebody other than Soriano is the guy at the back of the bullpen?
Well, unlike most managers I've covered, Matt Williams is not going to take forever to figure out who's going to be the guy. I mean, just like, who's ever successful right away, I think he'll use that guy. And I think right now, if I had to take a guess, it would be Storen, but I just can't say right now, because he kept saying, I'm using players based on matchups. So that's why it's kind of hard to just pinpoint who the guy is, but I think it could be Storen.
So is this, to some extent, is there some auditioning going on here with these guys?
Oh, no question about it. It's audition, all around this team. So, even with the starting pitching, because, I don't think you're going to see all five guys in the rotation, for example, pitching in the playoffs. I think one of them will be going in the bullpen, in my opinion. So we'll see what happens.
So to turn away from this topic, once again, Nats and Braves get together, and once again, it's a situation where the Nats are ahead and have a chance to really finish off the Braves. Are they viewing it in that regard as they go into a series with Atlanta? Are they viewing this as a real opportunity to kind of finally salt this thing away?
Well, I got to tell you, Matthew, if you talk to Matt Williams, he will. If you ask him that same question, he'll say one game at a time. I don't think about the future. I just think about today. That's what he's going to say. But yes, to answer your question, there's no question they got to seal the deal now. They have to do it because so they can pad their lead, and I think it would be a great thing for the Nationals. They have to do it. They have to sweep the series.
It is kind of interesting because it's late in the season, and a big lead late in the season is awfully valuable. It's really tough to overcome that. But given the history between these two teams and given that Washington has had trouble with Atlanta, you do kind of wonder about what happens if they do allow the Braves a little crack in the door. It's hard to say the Braves would win the division. It's awfully hard to see that with the math. But, it does seem like if they don't shut the door there, this might be an awfully interesting couple of weeks. I mean, do you think that's a fair way to look at it?
Yes, there's no question about it. I mean, they can't, to me, as far as I'm concerned, they can't allow the Braves to win this series. I mean, they have to show that they're the best team in the East. And by doing that, in my opinion, they have to sweep the series. I mean, they have problems with so many of their players that it's not funny. So you just hope that they can stop them, read the scouting reports, watch the videos, and get things done correctly. So we'll see what happens.
I was looking at you had a piece recently about Adam LaRoche, and it's clear that he's a guy that's really well-regarded in there. But he's a guy who's historically been a real second-half terror, and it's been the opposite this year. What's going on with LaRoche? Because, he's usually a guy who maybe starts slow and comes on strong. It's kind of been the opposite this year.
Well, he's doing something that he hasn't done, at least in the first 3 years he was here. he's gone the other way quite a bit. If you notice, against the Dodgers, the home run and the hit and the double he had, it was, you know, to left field. So, and I think he did that basically because he was injured. He was trying not to do too much. He's dealing with some ailments like the back, the flu, and the elbow. So I think he's trying not to do too much. It's helping his swing, believe it or not. And he's been getting the job done. He had two homers the other day. And, wow, I mean, it would be sad to see him leave, because not only is he a clutch hitter, he's a great clubhouse guy. And I think he's one of the reasons the Nationals are where they are, especially the last 3 years. There's no question in my mind.
Well, Bill Ladson, thanks for taking some time here to chat on MLB.com Extras, talking Atlanta Braves with MLB.com's Braves beat reporter, Mark Bowman. Mark, you are coming to us from Washington, D.C., where you don't want to overstate it, but it feels an awful lot like a really enormous series for the Braves. Now, some people will be listening to this after the series is over, but how big a series is this? For the Braves, I mean, obviously in the division, but really in the wild card race as well.
Yeah, I mean, they cannot continue to play 500 ball the rest of the way and assume that there's going to be a playoff spot there. Not assume or to even expect there's going to be a playoff spot there for them. You know, they have been quite fortunate to be able to do that here for a few weeks now, and even with the Brewers' troubles, even, you know, claim a tie for that second wild card spot a couple days recently. But, you know, they have got to get on a roll. They've got, like you said, they've got this three-game series in Washington this week. They've got three more against the Nats next week. And, you know, the division race is what it is. If there's absolutely any chance of them winning the division, they've got to win all six of these games based on what we've seen the last couple weeks. So, you know, at any time, it's quite difficult for any team to win six straight against another in the span of a week or so, but especially from what we've seen from the Braves the last couple of weeks, they just have got to find a way. And you hear it time and again, but it's the truth. They've just got to find a way to win every series the rest of the way out. You know, yes, it'd be nice if they could match up against the Nationals and make things interesting down the stretch. But, you know, you want to win these games not only to get in a wild card, but also, you know, if you do get in the wild card, win that wild card game, maybe if you match up against the Nationals, maybe you still have that mental edge that they've created by dominating this season series between these two division rivals the last 2 years.
Yeah, are the Braves the only team that looks at the schedule and says, oh, right, Jordan Zimmermann and Steven Strasburg this week?
Yeah, you know, especially Strasburg. You know, Zimmermann is a guy who they've had a chance to see here and there. What really has been their recipe for success has been Strasburg and Gio. And Gio is not going to be pitching here in D.C. this week. You know, Zimmermann, it's been off and on, but he's had more success against the Braves than Gio. You know, to the opener, you know, going up against Pfister. Pfister, the guy who has given them trouble here this year, the one start that he's made against them, and he struggled here recently. But he's a guy that you know, if they see him again next week in Atlanta, it's good to get a couple looks at him, just in the event that maybe you do see him during the postseason. But like you said, they are one team who, when they look at the schedule, that they enjoy it when they get to see Strasburg.
You had a piece recently about the way the Braves use Evan Gattis, and sort of an interesting question, because we've talked some about worries about him physically, how he holds up, is he wearing down, and yet at the same time, you know, there's now the perfectly understandable and reasonable notion that they want to lean on him more because he's one of their key bats. How does Freddy Gonzalez kind of manage that balance between, on the one hand, a guy that you worry about wearing out, on the other hand, a guy you need in your lineup when you're scratching to score runs?
Yeah, I mean, he, one way, I think the one reason they're going to do this is that they do have a couple off days coming up and a three-game series there in Dallas in which they can use Gattis as the DH. So that allows them to get some of the rest and keep his bat in the lineup. The interesting thing is how would Evan get through this week's series in D.C.? Because Wednesday, during the series finale, that would be his sixth straight game. And that's something that he has not done. That last game of the series is a 4 o'clock start. So it's not even, complete 24-hour turnaround. The one thing I can say is Freddie, toyed with this idea, and the announcement was made Sunday morning. He met with Gerald Laird and basically told him, look, I don't know how much playing time you're going to get the rest of the way, and Laird's playing time was threatened with the promotion of Christian Bethencourt anyhow. But he just laid it out to him and said, look, I'm going to lean on Evan Gattis, who, less than 12 hours earlier hit a game-winning home run against the Marlins. Gattis is bad. He hasn't had the same kind of consistency here during the second half of the season they did during the first half, but he is that one guy in that lineup that has still provided some instant offense, especially the last couple weeks. I think at one point that with that Marlins home run, that was his fifth home run in a span of like 60 at-bats. And, if you look at this team's offensive struggles, you said it, Matthew. I've said it. It's a team that's built to provide power, and they've been powerless for the most part, especially during the second half of the season.
And there's all kinds of complications here because, obviously the Braves are playing for a postseason spot here, but there are also some questions to be established for 2015 at catcher. I mean, it's such a complicated thing because, there is this question of, is Gattis the catcher next year? Is Gattis somewhere else next year? Is there any pressure or urgency or anything to get some major league at-bats and innings for Bethencourt to find out whether he's the 2015 catcher? I mean, can they even be really addressing that while they're in a pennant race, or is that something that just necessarily has to be put off?
I think that's something that's going to have to necessarily be put off, especially just the testing, like just to put him in there. I can't see them doing that. At the same time, I do not see Gattis catching every game the rest of the way. I mean, and if it comes down to putting either Bethencourt or Laird back there behind the plate, I think Bethencourt will be put back there. And, would they like some more time to see whether he is ready? Yeah, sure. But I think that the time that they saw when Gattis was on the DL at the end of June, first couple of weeks in July, I think they saw enough there from Bethencourt to say he's ready. And Eddie Perez said it the other day. Time and again, you hear, this guy is skilled defensively. He's not ready. He's not this. And you'd hear from some scouts around the league, he's a little bit lazy behind the plate. And Eddie Perez, I remember him challenging him a couple years ago, but Eddie a couple days ago told me what I saw from him and when he was up in June and July was he had the passion. They've seen the talent. They saw him prove productive while he was on the field. And they're starting to see a guy who is maturing, as a young man as well. So I think that they are pretty confident he's ready, if they're able to make a move. I know I repeatedly said they'll try and trade him, and I do think that they will try to trade Gattis. I've even heard again within the last couple of days, maybe you move him to the left field again next year. Now, when I say that, I will say that is just something being proposed again. I mean, that's just something, one of the many things you talk about. I'm not saying that's a death. Something they would definitely do, and if they would, the big fear remains. He had a negative 10 defensive WAR out there last year. It's a liability. The question is, does he hurt you as much out there or any more than he has behind the plate? How are you affected, with your other outfielders? So there will be some changes made here. Whether that means Gattis is moved, traded to a different team, which I'd say is probably more likely, or sent back to the outfield, there will be changes made, I think, that will allow Bethencourt to begin the next season as the starting catcher.
Can Gattis affect that decision at all over these final weeks? In other words, if he kind of bounces back, shows that he's strong, shows that in September he's still got something in the tank, reminds them of what he offers at the plate, is anything going to hinge on kind of what they see from him over these last few weeks?
I think that probably could influence some decision. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, he's going to always have that big body. He's going to be you're going to fear when he might break down. He's limited. He's always going to be limited from a defensive standpoint, especially in comparison to Bethancourt. I think all of those things are going to remain. If he goes on some kind of tear and continues to, you know, puts this team into the postseason and continues to be a fan favorite, though, continues to be a fan favorite, but adds to the love that the fans have for him, then, yeah, I guess there would probably be a little more hesitation when it comes time to move him. But from a strictly planning and baseball, if you're thinking just about the future from a baseball standpoint, I don't think any of the factors are going to change all that much.
There's some tried and true front office wisdom, though, that says if you listen to the fans, soon you'll be sitting with them. So
yes, I think so. You're right.
So hopefully they're not listening to that too much. But anyway, Mark Bowman, thanks for stopping in to chat on MLB.com Extras, talking Miami Marlins with MLB.com's Marlins beat reporter Joe Fusaro. Joe, the Marlins are sometimes a weird team to follow, and they're so committed and so built around their starting pitching, and yet somehow here in the second week of September, they end up with Brad Penny in their starting rotation. He's struggling. It seems like they've had some arms. What has happened to end up with Brad Penny getting starts for a team that's trying to contend for a playoff spot?
Well, a couple of things, Matthew. You had Henderson Alvarez in his oblique strain, which, you know, put his season in jeopardy. I think he will pitch again, and they hope sometime soon. But, you know, with him going out, and obviously with Jacob Turner traded and, you know, some other little bumps and bruises along the way, they, mainly Andrew Heaney, their top prospect, who's been called up in September, but they didn't feel was quite ready to get a start just yet, pushed Brad Hand right back into the rotation. And Brad's had one of those interesting years. He was very good in spring training. He's a kid who's out of options. He's 24, left-hander, with good stuff, but not always great command. And when he's on, he's capable of doing very good things, but, you know, like a lot of young kids, very inconsistent. So, you know, yet again, an opportunity for him these final few weeks to show as they move forward and think of the, you know, finishing strong and then going into 15, whether he's, you know, going to fit into the equation. I know they want him to, because he's a left-hander with a 95-mile-an-hour fastball who shows just enough signs of progress that makes that intrigues you, and they'd like to see him seize the moment. He hasn't totally. He comes off a very good outing against the Braves, beating Julio Teheran, of all people. Yet, you know, other games you'll see him in must-win type things, and he's had a game in the third inning. So Brad's going to have to show a little more consistency with command and earn that spot. But the spot's kind of fallen to him by default, and he sometimes shows he's deserving of it, and other times shows why they're looking at other people as well.
Not to beat a dead horse, but on a topic that I, again, sort of that jumped out at me in the very first place, but does this magnify or in any way sort of bring any second thoughts about the decision to let Turner go?
I don't think so. You know, he was a guy who, you know, they gave that a lot of thought. You know, if in the perfect world, when he was throwing well in spring training, if they had doubts that he could have the consistency, they probably should have looked to, and Brad Hand was in the same boat too. You know, you could have probably done something, you know, without having to feel like your roster is kind of stretched and, you know, the guy's not a fit and he's just hurt me in too many spots. But I think that the Marlins traditionally, when they make moves, they do it and turn the page, and if the next guy doesn't pan out, they will look to replace that guy as well. So, you know, I think they saw enough examples with Jacob Turner that they weren't confident it was going to work with them. So they made that move, which obviously for a guy that you traded for the pieces you traded him to Detroit for or in 12 and Anibal Sanchez and Omar Infante, and then you put so much into him and just to see him pretty much walk. It's a natural question, but the way the team looks at it is they hope that the guys that they already have in their system will be what Jacob Turner will be on his best day, and there's still a jury if he's really, you know, going to be a number five type of guy or a guy with a lot higher ceiling.
You mentioned Henderson Alvarez, who you know, his issues have really been challenging for a team that's already down its number one. What is his status as far as the immediate future in the next few weeks this year?
You know, he threw a bullpen session on Sunday, and the sounds of it all went well. But I think they really have to be careful here. You know, you don't want an oblique injury to turn into an arm injury by overcompensation. You also don't want to, if you're not fully in it, to rush him back. So if I'm the Marlins, I better be completely convinced he is not hurting himself to throw six or seven innings. Or they should just say, you had a great year, you were an all-star, you showed a lot of signs, for the most part, you were durable until the end. You know, you were had bumps and bruises along the way, but really never missed a start or only pushed back a day or two when you did. Don't chance anything. And apparently his last outing, he went, three-plus innings against the Mets, and fastball, I think, max was 90-91, and that's never a good sign. So I'd be really, really careful, and I think that's where they are right now.
Yeah, that leads into my next question, because I was actually wondering about that exact thing. You know, you say from your perspective that's what makes sense. I think I agree. Do you get the impression that the club is getting close to that point where maybe they start thinking about whether discretion is the better part of valor when it comes to Alvarez?
Yeah, I think so. I think they're realistic. You know, they know, you know, even though the math is there for them, you know, they haven't won two in a row in about a month. You know, although they've won a series now and then and done just enough to kind of stay on the charts. But I think it's going to be that late push, you know, unless Henderson is, like I said, ready to go. And he told me the other day he would pitch, and just knowing him, he probably will. But whether or not he's going to be healthy enough, then, you know, you just kind of say, just don't do anything stupid now. Had a great year. The kid showed a lot of fun. He's only, he's like 24 years old. He's still a really young guy, and he's in the league, 3 years? So this guy has a lot of upside, and he's shaping up to be the number one starter on opening day next year. So they better be handling with care, and they are. But you know how competitiveness is, where he may say, I'm pitching, and the pitching coach may sign off, and the manager as well, and then the front office signs off, and then you just keep your fingers crossed. But, I'm not totally convinced he's ready to pitch this year.
As you talk about the kind of reality of the situation of a team that put up a lot better fight than I think a lot of people expected, one of the conversations that's going to start coming up is MVP. And I know I feel pretty strongly that it's not a player's fault if the guys around him didn't get into the postseason. But if you had to make a case for Giancarlo Stanton as the MVP on a team that's four games under 500, how do you make that case?
Well, you make it just on his production in across the board on pretty much every significant power number. And besides that, he's close to hitting 300, but he's leading home runs, RBIs, slugging percentage, on-base percentage, intentional walks. You know, he's just done so much, you know, in the middle of a lineup that many wondered, is he ever going to see a pitch all year? I mean, this team clearly doesn't flirt with 500 if Giancarlo Stanton was hurt. You know, they've been without Jose Fernandez, and they are still close to 500 and a hot week away from, you know, and some strange things from a second wild card. So if he can finish strong and they can finish, you know, around 500, I think that greatly enhances his chance of a really special season for a very dynamic and game-changing player.
Well, and I think you kind of touched on, I think, what to me is the other topic there, is that even if you make it about value to team, and I think that's the argument, the counter-argument a lot of people make. It's a really big deal for this team to be close to 500 and in the mix, isn't it? I mean, there really is a difference between whether they were 65-97 or whether they finished with 77-78 wins, right?
Oh, correct. Absolutely. I mean, as a team, I mean, you know, 100 losses is that, you know, the people around that team every day, the, you know, the hardship of coming to a ballpark knowing it's probably going to be a long day, day after day, and the grind of that, and to make such a substantial progress in the standings when many thought they'd finish last place yet again, and all those things we talked about, how no one, oh, how Sam to hit any home runs, you're not going to see a pitcher all year. For the guy, he's become more of a player, Matthew, as someone who's seen him and met him the day pretty much he was drafted, and seeing him as this really big, trip, you know, three-sport athlete out of California who, man, it was like you could hit the ball really far, but you didn't know if he could play the game at this level, and showing signs and stretches that this guy could be the best player in the game, you know, hasn't shown it consistently enough in my book to completely earn that. But, you know, you're seeing a complete ball player who's determined to play 162, which I know is going to make all the teams in the playoff race happy, that he wants that on his resume, that the day that they seem to fall out of it, if they're four games to go against the Nationals or something, and overall first place home field advantage in the playoffs on the line, that Stanton's not going to be sitting around going, nah, I don't think I'm playing today. I'm happy with what I did. You know, he's a guy completely committed to being the leader on this team that is asking a 24-year-old to be the leader on. It's been a remarkable year, and I'm very impressed with his maturity this year and his just unwavering focus from what he aimed to do basically from the day he got off the plane from California to South Florida to start spring training.
All right. Well, Joe Fusaro, thanks for joining to talk a little baseball here on MLB.com Extras. Talking New York Mets with MLB.com's Mets beat reporter Anthony DiComo. There was some news in the past few days that it was kind of news and it kind of wasn't. The Mets are now apparently officially or unofficially, but really very close to shutting Matt Harvey down for the year. How close are they? What's actually going to happen when this time comes that he throws in anger for the last time in 2014?
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's, you know, you can call it news, you can call it inevitability. And, you know, I almost kind of hate the word shut down because it makes it sound so final, almost like there's something wrong. You know, nothing's wrong here. This is sort of the plan in basically everyone's mind but Matt from day one. You know, there was never really that thought that he was going to pitch this year. I know he wanted to, and the team let him humor that at first and sort of took it away from as the year went on. But, yeah, I mean, he's basically going to wrap up his program. He's not going to throw competitively as he thought he might have at some point. You know, they kicked around the idea of the Arizona Fall League at one point. They kicked around some other things. But it's not going to happen. I mean, they're going to be very cautious with him. They're obviously not making a playoff this year. There's just no reason to have Matt Harvey this year. And there's every reason in the world to have him 100% healthy going into next year, where he could conceivably give you a full or close to full healthy season. So, you know, it was, like I said, it is more an inevitability than anything. And you're just sort of seeing the hard, juicy aspect of that service now.
So, following this, as Harvey goes into the winter, Is this going to be a relatively normal winter as far as how long he takes off, what part in the off season he starts throwing, how he goes from flat ground to bullpens and all that? Or is this still going to be a winter that is more like a rehab winter or a winter of an injured player?
Yeah, I think relatively normal is a good way to put it. I mean, he's going to be as normal or following as normal progression a player can coming up here, which he didn't pitch at all. I mean, obviously, there's still going to be some elements of rehab in there. He's still going to be strengthening that elbow and that arm as much as he can. But for the most part, you know, once he starts throwing, once he gets out to Florida, gets to the journey, he's going to be on that sort of normal-ish progression that any pitcher would be on. He's going to be trying to build up start to start so that once he gets out of spring training and is ready for opening day, he's at that point where he can give you 6-7 innings, start, whatever it may be. Now, all that being said, the Mets are obviously going to be more careful with him than they would be with any other pitcher. You know, they're not going to push him, especially not in spring training. I think, you know, come April, you're not going to be seeing him. You're not going to see him going super deep in games. And as summer goes on, as that elbow and that shoulder and that arm get stronger and stronger, you know, then you're going to first see them unleash it a little bit more. But for the immediate future, yeah, it's going to be a normal shutdown this winter, a normal start back up, and a normal progression, or as normal as it can be coming off surgery like that.
As they look at how they handled Harvey, and I don't think really anybody's suggesting that he was mishandled, but as they address all this and try and figure out, and as the whole industry tries to sort out how to keep pitchers from breaking, it seems like from reading there's been some conversation about some of the workloads on the guys who are healthy, and in particular Zach Wheeler. Is there any tension within the organization as far as game day handling of these young pitchers in a season where, as you noted, there's probably not a playoff berth on the line?
Yeah, I mean, the Mets have been very careful with Zach Wheeler and Jake DeGrom and these guys, but they really were, if you go back and look at it, just as careful with Matt Harvey. And if anything, he's sort of the poster child where these limits, these arbitrary restrictions that people, the teams and managers and general managers are putting into place really aren't working. I mean, the Mets were as cautious as you be with Harvey. And granted, Harvey had a history in college back in the days at North Carolina where he was in sort of massive pitch counts and games, and maybe that has something to do with it. But, yeah, while these guys are studying what's right, what's wrong, and what's going to lead to healthy elbows and what's not, I guess that accepted science or I don't know if science is the word, Matt Harvey's kind of that poster child that it's not working because they handled him carefully. And from the day he was drafted, and he's still, quote-unquote, broke. They're doing the same thing with Zach Wheeler and Jake DeGrom. But what else can they do at this point? We have a limit of what we know, and it's kind of hard to say that they should be doing something different when we don't really have a good alternative.
I had just, I guess, read that there was some concern in some quarters about the amount that those guys were working this year, but there's not. That was overblown.
Well, the Mets have their formula, and it's not exactly 30 innings, but it relates to roughly 30 innings over the previous year's total. Both those guys are going to fall right into that range, so the team's certainly not worried. And again, these guys break all the time. It's been really an awful year or two for Tommy John patients. So whether that 30 innings thing is smart or maybe really dumb, we don't know. So you could certainly argue that the Mets aren't doing the right thing with any of their young pitchers, and you could argue that with a lot of teams. But as far as the conventional wisdom, which, again, I don't know how wise it is at this point, they've been following it, you know, to a pretty appropriate degree, I would say.
They're slotting in another of this army of young pitchers, Rafael Montero. What are the plans for him?
Yeah, Rafael's, he had a okay season. He had a good season at AAA. They brought him up. They started him a couple of times. And he really struggled more than he didn't struggle in the big league. But they're going to give him another look in September. They talked about starting him. It sounds like now they're going to give him a look at bullpen. And he's just another good young arm. He doesn't have the ceiling of a Noah Syndergaard, so to speak. But he really does have that middle of the rotation ceiling for his guy. He's always shown great control. He regressed in that area a little bit this year. But, you know, he's got a good race. They still think he can be a starter. They're going to get his feet a little wetter so that he can really legitimately come in and compete for a rotation spot next spring.
Is there such a thing as too many starting pitchers?
I think the Mets have actually proven that there's not. I mean, all we've been hearing with this team for years is depth. That's the strength of starting pitching depth. And you look up, yeah, they still have it to a certain extent. They're going to have sort of that roster crunch where they're going to look at the trademark full of blown this winter. But which of these guys can you really rely on and know that they won't get hurt? You know, John Neese said, lots of injury issues in the past 2 years. Dylan Geese has injury issues. Zach Wheeler is one guy who's been healthy. You've got Harvey coming off surgery. You've got some of these young kids who are on purpose. So, no, I mean, I really think there's not. And the Mets obviously agree with that because they've shied away at every opportunity for trading this in pitching, and they seem like they'd rather go forward here with a surplus of that versus strengthening up another area that they really need, which would be awesome.
If they were going to trade somebody, I was thinking about this. Is there not a case to be made, given all of these variables, that it makes more sense to trade one of the kids and A, get the higher value and maybe get some sort of significant impact to your everyday lineup, and B, actually hold on to a guy who is at least something approaching a sure thing in Cologne? I mean, is there, as they look at how they build this 2015 roster and how they get to have a lineup that's good enough to contend, is there any notion that maybe the way to go is hold on to Cologne for another year and get creative with maybe one of these young pitching assets in order to do a significant upgrade?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge notion for that. I think there's a very good argument that can be made for that. You've heard John Neese's name already come up a little bit. He's got a super team-friendly contract. Now, maybe he wouldn't get the best value because of his recent injury history, but you could certainly make an argument that trading him would be a smart move. Or you can make an argument that trading one of these pitchers, Noah Syndergaard or Rafael Montero, would be a smart move. The main issue is, you know, a lot of teams have good young pitchers these days, and a far rarer asset would be that impact power bat, which Mets really need. I don't see a scenario in which you give up Noah Syndergaard by himself and get that impact bat that's close to majors or even in the majors already. You know, you're going to have to give up 2, 3, maybe even 4 legitimate to get a guy like that, to get a guy who can come up and really establish himself in the middle of your lineup the year or two. And, you know, once you do that, if it's Mets or if you're any other team, all of a sudden you look down and your pitching depth isn't any better than any other team. So it's going to be an interesting winter to see what they do. It certainly looks like they should and will make a move with their rotation to at least shore something up. But in terms of a huge blockbuster, I'd frankly be surprised at this point.
All right. Well, Anthony DiComo, thanks for taking some time to talk here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Philadelphia Phillies with MLB.com's Phillies beat reporter, Todd Zielecki. Todd, I have what may seem like a silly question, but I really am kind of wondering. As the Phillies continue to play really pretty decent ball for a fairly lengthy period of time, if we're being fair about it, is it a big deal for them to stay out of last place at the end of the year?
I think for, you know, kind of moral victories and things of that nature, yeah, they would like to, you know, finish as high as they possibly can, even though ultimately it's not going to mean much in terms of a postseason berth. But I think there are some guys in this team, you know, well, I should say, I think there are guys in this team, I think, that take a lot of pride in what they do, and a lot of these guys that were part of those 5 straight division titles, you know, they don't want to, you know, finish the season in the basement. They want to, again, even though it would just be 4th place or whatever, they would prefer to stay out of there if they can, and at least finish the season strong and go into the off season and feeling a little bit better about themselves. Again, not that it's going to mean a postseason berth, and in the end, you still haven't made the postseason since 2011, but they finished strong and outplayed some teams down the last month and a half would mean something to them.
You can parse selective endpoints and you can play with sample sizes and all of that. So it's obviously worth kind of grain of salt. But as we talk right now, the Phillies have played half a season as a 500 team. They're 41-40 in their last 81 games. Now, that's almost certainly not what they want around there. I mean, the goals are higher, and finishing 500 I don't think is really acceptable or the priority. But I think it's better than the perception of them overall has been. And I think what I wonder is, from that 3 months of ball, what of it is predictive or valuable going forward, and what of it is kind of noise or smoke and mirrors?
Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind when you mention the record in their last 81 games is a comment that Pat Gillick made last week in Atlanta when he talked about he kind of went back and forth on a lot of things he said, but one of the things he said was, you know, you look around the National League, and he said, I don't see that many dominant teams. So a tweak here, a tweak there that works out, and, you know, this team could kind of get back into contention. And I think that's kind of what he's talking about. He looks back at these last 81 games, and and sees a team that is 500, not great, obviously, not a postseason team, but he looks at it and says, okay, if we can make a good move or two or three or whatever in the offseason, maybe this team turns things around and, you know, can at least get it back into wild card contention. So, but in terms of predictive things, I think they really like the fact that their bullpen is pitched well, and I don't think it's just kind of a flash in the pan thing. I mean, if you watch Ken Giles pitch, he's legit. You know, Papelbon, as much as the Phillies would like to trade him, and as much as he's kind of irritated the fan base, and as much money as he's made, he's pitched very, very, very well this season. Jake Diekman has come on really well. Justin DeFreitas has come on really well. So the bullpen is really good. Now, to me, the big issue going forward is that offense. I don't think Chase Utley and Ryan Howard should be the number three and number four hitters, you know, of the future. They need to find somebody to kind of hit in that middle of the lineup, which is a tough part. But, you know, there are some reasons to be encouraged. And, again, like Pat Gillick said, you know, a tweak here or a tweak there, I think he's looking at. And this team could actually – I'm not saying they would become the National League East favorites next year, but – certainly a team that could be playing in some meaningful baseball at this point next year if they make the right moves.
What can be done for the lineup, either internally or externally? I mean, I think, once again, it feels like a kind of a broken record. That actually means a music-playing device for you youngsters out there. It seems like a broken record to say it's not a great free agent class, but I don't think it's a great free agent class. So what can they do to get that lineup to be where they want it to be and where I think we're all kind of used to seeing Phillies lineups being?
Yeah, that's the really tricky part, and I think that's also why, in the same breath, when Gillick said, tweak here, tweak there, we can get back into contention, but then he says, boy, but, you know, you look at it and you say it might take longer than expected to get this thing turned around, because Ruben Amaro has said several times, we've got to improve our offense next year. We've got to improve our outfield play. I think a lot of that starts in left field with Dominic Brown's struggles. They have some options. They could have Darren Ruff and Grady Sizemore maybe platoon in left field. They got to hope that Ben Revere, who's pursuing a batting title, can keep playing like he is. But there are no quick fixes, and that's the thing. You know, I think they're going to try to trade Ryan Howard to an American League team in the offseason. Maybe that opens up a door for Michael Franco, but a rookie player is probably going to struggle. Just Cody Ashe has struggled this season at times. So offensively, it is going to be tough to find those three and four hitters. And I've talked to any big-time hitter worth his salt has pretty much been locked up to a long-term deal, and that's what makes this thing so difficult. And like you just mentioned, you look at the outfield, free agent outfielders coming up in this offseason, and there's nobody that you go, Phillies should be in on this guy, other than that Cuban outfielder, Yosmani Tomas, and I do think they're going to take a run at him, and hey, if they can sign him, and if he's the real deal, then maybe you have a number four guy that can pop 30 home runs, and I think that would make a huge difference.
It kind of leads me to something I've been thinking about for a while. When you talk about some of the internal options, and you look at Ashe, and you look at Michael Franco, you know, one of the things that was really a hallmark of those really good Phillies lineups from 5, 6, 7 years ago, and a lot of those guys were homegrown, so it's not like they were bringing these guys from outside, was they didn't just have power, but they had really good strike zones, and they had some homegrown guys with really good strike zones, and it seems like in recent years they are not developing guys with good strike zones. Franco doesn't have a good strike zone. Dominic Brown, even when he was good, didn't really do a good job of controlling the strike zone. Is there a difference in instruction? Is that just something that's happened with three or four guys and then three or four other guys? What is the difference between the kind of hitters they developed not that long ago and the kind of hitters they're developing now?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, when you ask the Phillies about this in terms of player development, has anything changed? They say, we're still stressing working the strike zone. And frankly, the feeling I get is that it just comes down to level of talent. You know, like Jimmy Rollins has had a ton of success in his career, has not really been a good strike zone type of guy in terms of working the count. But, you know, he had success, and that's just kind of the way he has been. And so the Phillies say that they have been stressing those same fundamentals to all their hitters through rookie league, you know, Venezuelan summer leagues and, you know, Dominican summer leagues and whatnot, and all the way up to AAA. But for whatever reason, they have not gotten those players that have really sort of adapted to the strike zone or at least been able to show an ability to kind of work the count a little bit. And that is an issue. And I think a lot of that kind of comes down to their drafts over the past several years. They've drafted their share of big league talents, but very few of those big league talents have been, impactful players. And so you have the amateur scouting people kind of saying, hey, once we draft these guys, we're not really sure what happens to them once they're in the system. And then, you have the player development guys say, hey, we can only, work with what we got, with what we've got. And so I think the truth is kind of somewhere in the middle in regards to, the ability to kind of develop some of these players. I think some of it's talent, and some of it you have to kind of look at and see, all right, how are these guys being instructed?
So, but that's not just an unfair perception then. I mean, there is some difference. And again, I'm not, not everybody's going to draw walks, but there's you can at least control the strike zone. And that, I guess what I hear you saying, tell me if I'm right, is that that's not just me as kind of an OBP geek seeing that. There is some kind of difference in the guys that are coming up and the guys that came up, 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, I think so. There definitely has been, a lot of these first-round draft picks that the Phillies have selected in the past several years have really, really struggled. They released Anthony Hewitt earlier this year. He was the number one pick a few years ago, struck out a ton, didn't walk at all. There's a lot of guys in the system like that. Larry Green Jr. is a first-round draft pick. He's really struggled. So there definitely has been a noticeable difference in those types of guys. A guy like Utley, who just works the count incredibly well. A guy like Carlos Ruiz has come up to the system, works the count very well. Those guys, they just have not been bringing those types of guys up.
Well, we're talking about this kind of hitter. One of them that fits that description, like I mentioned, is Michael Franco, and he's a guy clearly who's got some serious hitting chops. He's up, and he's got 8 at-bats. What's the plan with Franco?
Well, that is the million-dollar question, because basically when they called him up last week, I think it was September 2nd he joined the team, they essentially said, and Ruben Amaro made it clear, you need to play him more than once or twice a week. Otherwise, it does nothing for his development. And Ryan Sandberg, I think, got that message because asked a few minutes later, how many at-bats would you like to see him get this month? He said 50 to 60 at-bats, which is, at least 10, 15 starts in that ballpark, depending on, how the game goes and whatnot. That is the plan. They want to play him fairly regularly. Now, he probably should be having, they definitely want to give him a few more at-bats maybe than he got this first week. And that's going to be the challenge. Ryan Sandberg's got a lot of guys he needs to get in there, but that is a guy, Michael Franco, you want to get him experience, because if the Phillies do end up trading Ryan Howard in the offseason, whatever that, for the 5% chance on that or a 10% chance or whatever, you want to at least know a little bit more about Michael Franco. If you see some good things from him this month, then maybe you feel a bit more comfortable going into the season. Maybe you don't feel like you need to go out and get an everyday first baseman, or maybe you feel like you can get a guy that can kind of platoon on the bench with him. There's a lot of different odd things that they could do. But that's why it's really important that Ryan Sandberg get him more playing time before the end of this month.
Okay. Well, Todd Zalecki, thanks for taking some time to chat here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.